This is part one of a special three-part series with top US carp on the fly angler, Dan Frazier. Welcome everyone to the American Carper podcast, where we discuss all things carp related in the USA. Featuring anglers' interviews, stories, and monthly competitions with traditional US and Euro anglers, fly anglers, and anyone who has a passion for this incredible fish, the carp, Cyprinus carpio. Much maligned and misunderstood, and undoubtedly one of the finest sport fish to be targeted here in the USA. This is where we, the guilty ones, can meet. My name is Sean Manning of the American Carp Society, and I'm grateful to be your host. Welcome, everybody. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already, and please share with your friends on your social media. The more the word gets out, the more we can do for this great fish here in the USA. Now, today we have a very special guest on the show, one of the original US carp on the fly anglers, advocates and ambassadors for both the sport and the species, Mr. Dan Frazier. Welcome, Dan. Thanks so much for joining me on the show, bud.
Hey, Sean, I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me. I always take the opportunity to talk about carp whenever I can.
It's been a while, isn't it, since we spoke last? I know there's a lot that we're going to talk about this evening. So what have you been up to most recently on the carp on the fly front?
Yeah, good question. So, you know, last time we spoke, it was a while back, and we were kind of, I'd say as a community in the United States, we were on the rise, right? When popularity was increasing, we had a lot of, of industry backers, a lot of people pushing to help mainstream these fish. In some ways it feels like a little bit of the excitement or the freshness maybe has slowed down. But in reality, what my experience is from just being out and speaking engagements and things like that is, we did a really good job. And a lot of at least in the fly world, a lot of fly anglers now, have accepted that this is a worthy species to chase. The worst argument I hear at this point now is instead of, you know, those fish don't deserve to be caught on a fly. Now I hear it's not my bag, but right. that's kind of where things have gotten. And what that's meant for me then was, a lot less of the, I actually have a few presentations I give when I do speaking talks now, and I present them at the beginning, and I say, do I still have to convince you that this is a worthy target, or can we go right to the how-to? And most of my engagements now, it's people saying, well, let's talk about how to do it. They no longer need convinced. So
that's great. That's great. And you're right. You hit the nail on the head. It's changed a lot since we first started, you know, talking about this and discussing this. And I have to say, the fly carping community has really kind of taken off, especially with the next generation. And we'll talk about that. We'll get into that a little bit. So the big question I wanted to ask you, how did you actually get started with fly fishing for carp? Because, you know, they weren't the most popular fish, you know. So how did that all begin for you?
Sean, that's a great question. So I went on a trip with my father and my uncle and my brother to Breckenridge, Colorado, and we decided on that trip we were going to take a half day lesson and then a day and a half guided fly fishing trip. And so we were all learning how to fly fish, and we fly fished, you know, small mountain streams, and I could see the fish in the water, which was exciting. And I really got hooked on the notion of fly fishing.
Yeah.
And I asked my guide, I said, gosh, I just love this, but there's no trout within 300 miles of where I live. And he said, well, you can catch anything on the fly. You can catch panfish and bass and all that stuff. So when I got back to South Dakota, I bought myself a cheap $100 Cabela's, you know, outfit with a half dozen flies and all kinds of stuff. And I went to the water, and the funny thing was, Sean, that what had really sparked my interest in fly fishing was the visual aspect of being able to see that trout and throw to it. And the carp were the only fish I could see in the water here.
Right.
So I started targeting them that way. And Barry Reynolds had written his book by that point, although I didn't know I didn't know about that book for years. So I just started reading anything I could about catching trout on the fly and then trying to translate it to what, well, how am I going to get these carp to eat? Yeah. And, for years, man, I used to lie to people on the river too. In South Dakota, they look at a fly fisherman sideways anyway, but then I'd lie to them. What are you fishing for? And I'd say, oh, bass, panfish. And meanwhile, I was fishing for carp the whole time. So, that's where it got started. And then my next trip with that same group of guys, my dad and uncle and brother, was to the saltwater, and we were fishing for redfish, which is a sight fishing game.
Very similar.
Yeah. Exactly. And that really solidified in me, like, oh my gosh, I can do this back home. It did take me a year and a half to get my first one, but
that's not uncommon to hear, Dan. That's not uncommon to hear, because, you know, they're easy to spot. They're not that easy to catch initially for the newbie fly angler, are they?
No, they're really difficult. And as a matter of fact, especially back then, because we didn't, I mean, heck, I didn't know. I'm going to sound like an old man here. The whole idea of carp flies, or what flies carp would eat, or what do they eat, or how do you present a fly to them? It was all, we were making it up as we were going along. And so that part was difficult. You know, Sean, the other thing that really was difficult, or made it more difficult for me, was I had a preconceived notion that these were big, dumb, and ate anything.
Right.
And so that underestimating my quarry a little bit, certainly made it very challenging early on, you know?
Right.
But now there's better resources. There's videos on how to make a presentation and things like that, which will still help. But at the end of the day, I mean, they're just not easy.
No, they are spooky. And you mentioned fishing for redfish, and there's a lot of carp anglers I speak to, carp fly anglers, that they go down and fish for permit and all different types of, you know, obviously it's an incredible approach. Do you fish any other styles at all, or I've always known you as, you know, a guy who fishes for fish with a fly rod. Do you use any other styles, or have you decided that is the way that you're going to approach everything?
Yeah. It's a good question. I grew up fishing bait, basically under bobbers or on the bottom for anything that would eat it. I mean, that was all, that was my concern. And so I have a mad respect for people who fish that way. Personally, I haven't fished for anything with anything but a fly rod for, a long, long, long time.
Yeah.
I know I've been with people while they did spin fish for species. I've even thought about putting some type of bait caster or something on my boat when I have anglers out there that can't do the fly fishing. But me personally, I just can't. It's all I want to do is fly fish, I guess.
And what is it about that? There's an art. There's something there that speaks to you. I can't relate. I'm not a fly angler, but I know for me, if I, my personal approach of catching carp, I love to catch them with a European float on a center pin reel, which is like a, you know, fly reel as opposed to a fixed base reel. Cause there's so much, this direct connection. What is it about that art of approaching them on the fly? Is it because you're sight fishing for them? You don't just blindly cast and hope that there's something there. You have to stalk your quarry, don't you?
That's really what it is for me. The lake I was at Saturday, for example, I waded a couple of miles of flats for carp, and I got a couple of shots about, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 feet further out in waist deep water. Yeah. There were probably hundreds of fish that were staged up, and they were jumping, but I couldn't see them. They were too deep. And so they just weren't, they weren't my, I wasn't going to catch those fish. And so, it really comes down to the fact that for me, it's the sight fishing that excites me. And seeing that fish, seeing it tailing or seeing it moving across the flat, trying to stalk up to within my casting range, my presentation range, picking the one I want. And when you're doing all that, there really isn't a better tool than a fly. It's not really even about limiting myself. It's that now I've got a very, very lightweight lure, effectively, that I can deliver at accurately at distance.
Yeah.
Doesn't cause a splash.
Yeah.
Doesn't spook fish. And I think, frankly, if I could sight fish for them without fly fishing, that would probably, I'd be certainly willing to give that a try.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure there's not a better tool for me to do what I do than my fly rod.
You're totally right, because the accuracy that you can get, and especially somebody of your experience, you can literally target the fish out of a pot of fish that you want to catch. The only thing I can think of, Dan, that would be similar would be, and this is a lot more common in Europe than it is here, is fishing for carp with bread flake on the top. It's just bread flake on a hook.
Yeah, it'd be very similar, very similar. Yeah. And I catch a lot of fish here that are eating on the top, and then I'll throw flies. Some of them, I've even had it in my box. Bread flies that look like bread. But that's exactly right. I mean, that gets me excited too. If I can see that fish, like you said, with bread flake, you can see him eating, and you're like,
yeah,
that's
you
the
can
one.
See the eat. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. And that's the thing, isn't it? That's the thing that really gets it. And that's why a lot of us carp langers, we love stalking them as opposed to sitting there and just waiting. So that tied into, and you mentioned something though that is very different that fly anglers do. You guys do a hell of a lot of walking, don't you? You said, I walked a few miles and I had a couple of shots. So you walked a number of miles for a couple of opportunities, because the thing is, with approaching them on the fly, from what I've learned from all the wonderful fly anglers I've been lucky enough to do interviews with, is you don't get two chances. If you blow it on that first thing, they're gone, aren't they?
That's exactly it. And there are times, so let's start with the exception to the rule, right? There are times when you could sort of post up on a rock or on a point or a feeder creek or something and have fish kind of cycling to you, probably. But 99% of the time, I'm moving across some kind of shallow flat, either on foot or like I said, in my boat, and I am finding groups, small groups, usually, sometimes singles, of fish that have moved up and for a short amount of time are going to feed in there, and then they're going to move back into deeper water.
Yeah.
When I screw that pod of fish up, which I invariably will do,
right?
They're all moving and they're not coming back.
Yeah.
So I got to just keep moving for the next one. And then the other thing that happens when you're sight fishing, or that I experience at least, is let's say I've got a fish at 40 feet. He's tailed up. He's eating well. I make a cast and he doesn't eat my fly. And I make another cast. He doesn't eat my fly. I'm going to continue to try to get closer and closer to that fish until I can feed him or he spooks. It's kind of one or the other.
Gotcha.
And once he's gone, I'm moving on. And we're covering a lot of ground. In fact, Sean, early in carp fly fishing, and your European anglers have been an extremely good ally for us in legitimizing this fish, both in the U.S. and overseas. I mean, the carp angler overseas. But one of the things I used to catch a little flack for was not using a landing net.
Right.
A landing mat.
Right.
And it was part of it, I think, was just a misunderstanding that,
90% of the time you fly anglers, you unhook them in the water anyway, don't you?
If all goes well, I'm never taking that fish out. I'm picking him up out of the water, maybe for a photograph.
Yeah.
But I'm up to my, my thighs in water the whole
exactly.
time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And then even when I do have to, and there have been occasional times when I don't have when I end up having to beach a fish or something, the idea of carrying a mat with me, and I don't think there's anything wrong with the mat. I think it's a good idea, but it just was one of those things where we had to make, the nets we were carrying were already bigger than we should have had for waiting that distance. And just was a gear, a call we had to make. Now, I do know that there are a few guys that are carrying mats at this point, and I think that's fine. I think it's a good way to handle fish if you're going to lay them on the bank.
Yeah.
But one of the things I used to do if I did have to put them on the bank is I'd make sure I had some type of, I wouldn't put on rocks or gravel or anything. I had grass and I would wet the grass. But all of that came down to that we had to be so mobile that it was just it was a challenge.
Hey, listen, I hear you, because if I go on, you know, if I've only got a few hours, I want to go and fish for them on the float. I'm not going to take alarms and fish for them on the bottom and just, you know, lug a half a ton of gear. And you need things to be, you need things to be mobile. I think the another, you know, misconception or a misunderstanding is the fact that most fly anglers, I mean, you guys are, you know, you're not sitting on a chair. I mean, you're usually in the water when you're targeting the flies anyway. And so most of the fly shots that we get from, fly anglers tag us with at the American Carp Society, 99% of them, the fly anglers are in, I mean, they're in the water, and the shots are in the water too, you know? So, and that's how they used to do it years ago when the European, they, you know, if you've got a lot of grass and you wet the grass and you, you know, as long as they're not sitting on top of rocks and they're covered in sand and dirt and stuff like that, you know, it's, you know, some things don't change and some things don't need to, you know,
well,
I mean, that doesn't need.
Well, like you said, you know, oftentimes we're staying in the water, which I think is good. But I also think that nothing I can stand, nothing bothers me more than game being wasted, right? So I'm a hunter and a fisherman, and I eat fish, and I hunt all different kinds of game, and so the last thing that we would ever intentionally do is cause some type of damage to a fish and let it go.
Oh, totally.
Me personally. But we have learned a lot about handling from you guys, which I think was really important, because in the early stages of this revolution, which is what we used to refer to it as, me and a small group of guys who were really heavily involved in it, early on in the revolution, a lot of people that were catching them were still
holding them like bass.
Yes. Almost abusive to the fish, right? Just a misunderstanding of what they couldn't do. Hell, when I started weighing my fish in the net, that was the first fish that I'd ever weighed. It was a whole process for me to learn. And for a lot of these guys, these fly anglers, they may never do that. But if they do, someone needs to teach them how to do it. Because
that's correct.
Yeah. We don't weigh trout, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think, you know, I think you're right. There's a lot that we've all learned from each other. I got to tell you that the photography side of the fly carp angling over the last few years has done an awful lot to propel the species into the forefront through social media. I mean, there's young guys getting into it, you know, and it's almost like a punk rock skateboard cool kind of edgy thing to fish for carp, which is wonderful. It's wonderful for the fish, and it's great because you're seeing there's a lot less bias now than there used to be. There just is. There's a lot less bias, and I think, as you mentioned, when people first get into anything, there are things that none of us know when we, you know, we do things the way that we've been taught, and we would see, you know, if we have a new angler getting involved, and you know, they may hold it incorrectly, and they could, only because they don't understand that when you get a larger fish, you know, the body, that the organs are not being supported in the water, and so you do have to handle it differently. But that's just educating people and stuff like that, and if it's done the right way, you see, that's the thing. If it's done with coaching and encouragement and a positive attitude to somebody, you know, 9 times out of 10, they'll turn around and go, "Oh, thanks for helping me out with that," and they'll make an adjustment. Nobody wants to be bashed over the head because they've done something that they didn't know any different. That's just no way to coach people up, you know.
That's right. And you know, you mentioned the photography. I've just been amazed. I mean, I've followed, just looking at the carp on the fly on Instagram, how many posts have been tagged that, and it's exploded. But I think that helps too, right? If you pictures of anglers that look like legitimate anglers, like people you would like to be like, and they're holding the fish appropriately and a few inches out of the water and reverently, right? It's not a joke that they caught this thing. I think that it informs how you act a little bit in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it does. And it's gone a long way into, and that was intentional. I mean, Wayne and I intentionally a number of years ago said, look, the only way to really help this fish is to present it as something that is, you know, that is revered. And so, I mean, we would give instructions like when you're taking pictures, you know, take any, you know, bait buckets out of the shot. I mean, the fish is the star. It's not about the angler. It's all about the fish. And if it's presented in the right way, I mean, you see some of these shots of these incredible, this incredible species and these fish, you can't but love them and respect them because the shot, the photography and the shots is just, they're so beautiful. And that's how you change the public perception, just by changing the way that it's presented to the public. And again, the fly anglers have done incredible job on that. I wanted to ask you about your book. When was the, you know, you had a, you have a book for Orvis, Orvis Guide to Carp Flies. How did that all come about? When did you start actually writing on the subject?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I started with an e-magazine, now defunct e-magazine. We rebranded to Carp Pro. Before that, I think it was U.S. Carp Fishing or something like that, U.S. Carp Magazine, U.S. Carp Pro Magazine. Anyway, I was working on that e-magazine, and this was right at – I was the fly fishing editor for at that point, and this was right as that sort of – I mean, this is just pure luck, Sean, but that revolution had kind of gone parabolic, right? All of a sudden, everybody was every line manufacturer wanted to sell carp lines. Every reel manufacturer wanted a carp engraving on it. Every rod manufacturer was asking us, you know, who, what is the right, you know, rod for carp. And I had done some work with Orvis, and they advertised a little bit, but mostly organizing a couple of tournaments and they had sponsored and given us gear for it. And then eventually actually we ran like a national online tournament at one point. But in that effort with them, Tom Rosenbauer, who was running their marketing department at the time, said, somebody needs to write a book of carp flies.
Right.
And he said, I think you're the one to do it. And I said, well, okay, I'd be happy to do that. I can pull together a lot of information and a lot of the flies. At that point, you know, flies were real regional and people were, you know, everyone had their favorite and Rosenbauer said, well, here's what we'll do. I'll help you, because Tom's written a number of books. I'll help you find a publisher, and if they buy, you write the proposal and all that crap. And if they buy it and it gets published, then I'll read it, and if Orvis will review it. And if we think it's good enough, we'll put it in the Orvis Guide 2 series.
Gotcha.
So that contract was actually not for an Orvis Guide book. It was just for Beginner's Guide to Carp Flies was just going to be a standalone book with the hope that Orvis, that it would meet Orvis's quality standards and that they would pick it up.
And they did.
So, yeah. And the funny thing was, Sean, I made my proposal and they came back and the publisher came back, Skyhorse, who did my publisher, came back and said, hey, this looks great. We'd love to do it, except you only have 66 patterns. You got to have 101. It's a catchier title. and I was like, how am I going to go find 35 more carp flies?
Well, that was a question I was going to ask you. How did you decide which flies to include? You know, I mean, well, actually, you kind of answered the question, because you, at that point in time, you had to come up with another 55 or 60 or whatever. So it's like, yeah.
there's a big resource for me was there used to be, and the blog still exists. I just don't think he writes much on it, but Fly Carpen, Trevor Tanner at Fly Carpen, had a really active blog that did a exceedingly popular fly swap. And fly swaps are these like little sort of local things that happen usually where, you know, everyone will throw in, you know, a dozen of their favorite pattern to tie, and then it gets all swapped around, right? Everybody gets two of each person's things, something like that.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. Well, Trevor's, because the fly carping community at that point was spread out across the U.S. and it was very isolated individuals and they all read the same websites, became very, very popular, hugely popular, to the point where we got that at one point sponsored. A bunch of free swag was sent out with everything. And he was able to fill all of the spots he had in, you know, a matter of minutes and things like that. So over the course of 4 or 5 years, he had done a number of swaps with a number of people. So I had examples on there of other patterns beyond what I was exposed to. So I could start with that and say, hey, this guy ties a mean fly. That's really good looking. And it's not like something I'm already using, and kind of, and start to organize it. But the other thing, and this is probably what I'm the most proud of with that book, was when I had the concept of breaking the fly selection down by food category. And so the way the book's organized is instead of coming at this the way most fly books do, which is, well, I shouldn't say most, there's all kinds of different ways to do it, but instead of coming at it from, you know, here's a whole bunch of flies and real in-depth discussion of what materials and what the tying instructions are and all that, I turned it around and said, well, that's not what's important here. What's important here is fly selection. Like, how do you pick the right fly? And so when I started saying, well, if here's a category of sort of mid-sized flies, and we're going to call that the meat category, and it's going to include small crayfish and damselfly nymphs and dragonfly nymphs. And I went through, well, what are the foods that carp eat in that category? And then I could break it down to, okay, now which flies best imitate those foods? Trying to make the angler understand that with carp, what I had learned and why I couldn't catch it for the first 2 years was that it was exceedingly important for you to identify what they're eating. And I didn't want the idea to be out there that, well, if you fish with this crayfish pattern, you will catch carp. What I wanted it to be was, hey, if you got fish that live in this environment that act this way, they may be eating crayfish. If they are in fact eating crayfish, here's three options for you that work on carp that are eating crayfish. Gotcha. And try to make the angler think about it that way. So anyway, long story short, once I had that concept about breaking it into those categories, it got a lot easier than to decide, well, what are my 101 patterns?
Because you're breaking it down it's like a menu. You're breaking it down into a food source, which is which actually makes a heck of a lot of more sense than just the technical side, because then the anglers also, you're educating the anglers a little bit there, I think, Dan, because then they're thinking more about what they're actually eating as opposed to, you know, how complicated the fly tying process might be.
Yeah. My buddy John always says that rule number one is to know the forage.
Yeah.
And that's one thing we early in our learning process overlooked. Right. And we were just calling each other and saying, hey, I got this thing and it looks like this and they seem to eat it. And then, you know, your buddy in the next county that you sent it to would be like, I can't, they'll run from it. I don't understand. Until we said, wait a second, I got to think about this a little bit smarter.
Yeah.
Like the trout anglers do. The trout anglers already do this. They come to a river and say, okay, what's hatching? What's in the water?
Yeah, they match the hatch, don't they?
Right. But the warm water fly fishermen, for some reason, don't do that. They just say, these are bass bugs, so I'm going to fish with these bass bugs.
Interesting.
And so we had to kind of go back to the old, in some ways, it's more like trout fishing than most warm water fishing, because it's a lot more about, or it involves that process of trying to match the hatch.
Yeah. Which makes a whole lot of sense, because you've got different times of the year. And I would imagine obviously the summertime and springtime is going to be the, you know, prevalent for you. But we've had, in some of our publications, we've had some great, you know, fly carp in the snow. I start thinking, what the heck are they eating when it's that cold and there's snow everywhere and stuff, but obviously they are.
Yeah. Well, you know? I tell you, I live in South Dakota. It gets Arctic up here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a stretch when I was really carp crazy where I caught carp for 30 consecutive months.
Wow.
Yeah. If I could find open water. And so, you know, obviously in February when it was 8 degrees at a high, I was fishing, you know, moving water or warm water discharges or things along those lines. Yep.
Yeah.
But if I could find open water, I could try to get a fish. And so it was much, it broadened for me that thought of, boy, they could be eating anything. Instead of, you know, if I only ever fish for them in May, I might think, well, they always eat, you know, whatever it is they eat.
That's
May.
A good, that's a really, really good point. That's a good point. Now, do you still do a lot of writing? You still do a lot of writing on the subject, or?
Yeah, I do. I write. I shouldn't say a lot. Not as much as I have in the past. I'd like. I intend to start doing more again. But I do write for a couple of websites pretty frequently. Gink and Gasoline is one of them. That's a really good fly fishing website, and I write for them quite frequently. Awesome. But most of my stuff now actually is, I do podcast interviews and I do a lot of speaking and presentations, but I'd really like to get back to the writing. It's just, you know, kind of got,
there's something about it, isn't there? I mean, this is wonderful with technology that we're able to have a conversation like this and put it on the airwaves and that type of thing. But there's definitely something about the written word and capturing that moment, on a blank piece of paper, you know, whether you're writing it or you're typing it, there's something magical about it. I love it, you know. Do you have any advice for those wanting to get into the writing side of things? From somebody that's, you know, you've been doing it for a number of years, you have any advice for, let's say, fly anglers that have never written anything and, you know, thinking about it?
Yeah. I do have some advice. The first piece of advice I think I would say is, you know, you talk to people about their experiences, and they speak to you in these wonderful colloquialisms and really neat, you know, uses of slang, and they have just a great command of the language and getting their ideas across when they're speaking to you. Mm-hmm. And then you ask them to write something and they sound like they're, you know, practicing nothing for the bar exam, you know, right. It's all where to for and you know, they get all weird. Write like you speak. Because if you do that, you can develop your own voice. And I think that's a part of it. Now, you know, spell things right and try to cut down on the curse words. But that's one thing I would say. And then I think the second thing is writing is a lot like, it's like anything else, in that you just got to do it a lot. And the more you do it, the better you'll get at it. I personally will sit down if I have a complex topic I'm trying to get across. I wrote a piece a few years ago about this pebble mine issue, and it was pretty complex where the issue stood from a regulatory standpoint and stuff at that point. For something like that, I'll make sure to outline my thoughts before I start actually typing it, just so I can keep track of where I am. Gotcha. And I don't become meandering. But within that, I try to explain it the same way I'm explaining something to, you know, a buddy at the bar, right? Mm-hmm. Not like they're dumb, but just, it can be simple. It can be, it can be plain language. And some of that stuff is absolutely the best. There's also just a ton of outlets that are looking for good content, but they also get a ton of bad content, right?
Yes, so, they do.
so you've got to send stuff. If you want to get it published, you just got to keep sending stuff. But no, if your stuff's quality, it will get recognized.
I think it will. That's very, very true. I mean, we say the same thing. We have an annual publication that we put out, and I think it's quite daunting for anglers that if they're not used to doing it. And I've experienced this before in the past with anglers. You know, the phenomenal anglers. But it's not for everybody. You know, that writing and putting that down and capturing that. But I must say, when you do find somebody, for being somebody who is I'm a fan of really of excellent writing. I mean, I love it. When you do see that, and sometimes I've seen it in a few young anglers over this past year, and I've almost strong-armed them. I'm like, you got to write, and you got to write more because you're really good, and you don't know it yet, but you just got to keep doing it.
Sean, oh my gosh, you're so right. You know, it's funny too because you can read the first two lines and go, oh, this is good.
Oh yeah.
I get books sent to me every now and again, and I got a couple of books sent to me, and one of them I read the first 10 pages and I was like, it's not going to do it for me. Right. Yeah. The other one, a buddy of mine had also gotten a copy sent to him. And I read the first page and I called him and said, all right, you got to pick that one up. That's a good, yeah. this is well, and you can just feel that craft. You know, it's interesting. I wonder, I listened to a podcast by a writer named Steve Rinella, who's an outdoors, he has a hunting TV show, but he's an outdoor journalist. And he has noted on a few occasions, and I think that I would amend his comments a little bit, but he has noted, as I've heard him interview authors, he's asked them, why do they believe that fly fishing tends to attract people who want to write eloquently about it, or is there something in the action of fly fishing that is there a quality to fly fishing that naturally attracts people? Here's where I would make an amendment to that. What I have seen in my exposure to carp is that international carp writing is very, very high quality. In fact, I think international carp writing, of fly or not, is as good as, I think it tends to be on average better than our non-fly fishing writing in the States. Our non-fly fishing writing in the States is all very technical and it's all very
how-to.
How-to, right. And I don't know what it is, but much like how a fly angler can write an entire story and you don't even know if he ever caught a fish, I've noticed that with the international fishermen too. They can write a whole story and all you learned about was the lily pad that he saw.
Join us in a few weeks for part 2 of this incredible interview.